From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what do voters think about Governor Snyder's plan to take millions from the school aid fund for Detroit schools?
Somewhat not surprising, a majority of the public was opposed to paying the debts of Detroit, about 64%.
We've got a new Michigan Radio PSC survey on the governor's Detroit school plan.
This proposal, as we know, has a long road ahead of it.
Plus, how Detroit and Flint lost millions in federal grant dollars after losing city employees in austerity cuts.
They lost that institutional knowledge, and with that, they lost the ability to really keep a handle on these grants.
And a Detroit poet writes of the wartime rapes of hundreds of thousands of Bangladeshi women.
I wanted to try to embody the voice of someone who had gone through that experience in wartime.
Those stories and more. It is a vicious cycle. Detroit and Flint lost millions in federal grant dollars after losing city employees to austerity cuts.
This is important for them to be able to show that they can manage their money to the feds and that they are worthy of this money. And so if they can't prove that, they're not going to get the money.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, is there an end in sight? But first, Governor Snyder recently unveiled a major new plan to overhaul public education in Detroit. The governor is proposing splitting the district into two parts. The old district would exist to pay off the school's $2 billion debt, with DPS's 47,000 students attending classes in the new district with an appointed school board. The plan would take $72 million a year out of the state's school aid fund, which means every other student in the state would get $50 less. What do voters think of this plan? As part of our Michigan's Pulse polling series, Michigan Radio and public sector consultants surveyed voters. Joining us once again is public sector consultants CEO Jeff Williams. Hello, Jeff.
Hello.
Always good to have you with us and find out what is on the minds of voters around Michigan. So this plan of the governor's controversial when he first announced it among some lawmakers, among Detroit teachers. So let's dig into the thoughts of voters. The first question we asked was, should the state assist in paying the debts of Detroit Public Schools? What'd you find?
Well, we found, somewhat not surprising, a majority of the public was opposed to paying the debts of Detroit, about 64%. About one in three were in favor of paying the debts of Detroit. That's not surprising, given, again, it may smack of bailout to some of the voters. It's a special treatment for a district. Figuring that might be the answer, we set up two follow-up questions to probe more deeply than just that kind of top-line answer.
And if a voter said yes, if they were among that 27.7% who said the state should help, you followed up with the fact that that money would come from money that normally goes to students outside of Detroit. So what did you find here?
One of the things in public opinion polling is when you kind of ask a generic statement, should we or shouldn't we, the needle starts at one point. But then as you add specifics, you watch how that needle changes. So We asked everyone who said yes or don't know, should we assist the Detroit Public Schools? We asked the follow-up, naming that the cost of that would be about $50 for each non-Detroit student over the next several years. The answer is then split, about 50-50. So even among the yes, we could move that needle to where half said, yes, I still continue to support, and the other half said no.
What does that tell you?
That tells me that, again, this is following kind of a classic voter response to a spending question. At the generic side, you kind of start with the what's called the baseline response. So it's about one in three say yes, two in three say no. You peel that apart farther, and it starts to split 50-50. It means this proposal, as we know, has a long road ahead of it. One in three voters willing to assist Detroit schools financially, that's a good starting point if you're trying to get to a half plus one or a 51% scenario. But when I can peel away half of your yes voters just by being a little more specific, that tells you how much work you have to do.
On top of the fact that overall it was a 2-1 in opposition. We then asked about who should control Detroit Public Schools, because as we know, since 2009, the state's controlled DPS through a series of emergency managers. What did voters have to say?
This was another question that we had added, again, testing how much people know and kind of what the attitude of the state is. The primary answer was that a school board should be appointed by both the mayor and the governor. That was at 35%. A locally elected school board came in second at 27%. And statewide, continuing the state-appointed emergency manager came in third at 20%. For those first two responses, actually, Detroit residents came in pretty close. The plurality, 39%, wanted a school board appointed by the mayor and the governor. Remember, it was 35% statewide, so only a four-point difference. 36%, meaning almost as many of Detroit residents, supported a locally elected school board. Of Detroit residents, only 3% supported the emergency manager continuing. Again, that's not a surprise at all.
I was going to say, I'm sure that didn't raise one single eyebrow when that one came in.
Not at all.
There were also, Jeff Williams, a couple questions about charter schools in Detroit. What did you ask and what did you find here?
So we asked here, just again, we tested a few surveys ago in partnership with Michigan Radio, overall opinions about charter schools. Here we noted that in general in the city of Detroit, there are about as many charter school buildings as there are traditional school buildings, about 100 each, and about as many students attend charter schools in Detroit as attend Detroit public schools. So we asked, do you think would opening more charters serve more children, would that better help improve education in Detroit? Would closing charters better improve education in Detroit, or do charters effectively make no difference in the quality of education in Detroit, meaning they neither hurt nor harm? And that third answer is what the plurality picked. 41% said changing the number of charter schools in Detroit would neither help nor hurt education. That doesn't surprise me, knowing kind of the demographics behind charters and also the performance of charters. The charter school movement in Michigan and its student count is now large enough that when you compare them as a whole, they're behaving just like public schools as a whole, meaning it's a large enough population that the law of large numbers, meaning it's the average performance is starting to be what carries the day. So from the performance side, we see no difference between the typical charter school and the typical public school. When you select out a single school, that's when we can tell you, does that school perform above or below expectations?
So are voters kind of going, yeah, whatever, about charter schools and the number of them?
I think from one perspective, you could read this as saying the kind of angst about charter schools has passed in public judgment. Mm-hmm. The majority of the public sees charters as an integrated part of the public education system and is kind of ambivalent. That same public, when presented with charters that do very well, is supportive of charters. That same public, when presented with charters that don't do as well, is negative toward charters. So their attitude toward charters really mirrors the attitude toward a traditional public school for most Michigan residents.
Now, finally, Jeff, and I found this a really, really intriguing question. We asked, does the state of Michigan have an obligation to ensure a quality education for all children in the city of Detroit? What was the answer?
The answer was an overwhelming yes. 82% of the respondents said that the state of Michigan has an obligation to ensure that quality education. This was that kind of companion question we put on. So we tested financing earlier in our discussion. Should we financially assist the Detroit Public Schools with some of the legacy costs or some of the costs borne or brought on by the emergency financial manager? We also wanted to test how much responsibility do you feel that the state has? And again, overwhelmingly, the answer is the state has what we're calling a moral duty to the Detroit Public Schools, as it does to the public education throughout the state. So it's in the details that differences emerge. How should we fulfill that obligation?
Yeah, because I'm just wondering how you reconcile that big 81.5, almost like 82%, as you said, that fact with the fact that, as we asked in that first question, 2-1, folks do not think the state should be paying or helping to pay for the debts.
And this is a really interesting both political and philosophical question, as some of the debts accrued by Detroit Public Schools were accrued by the emergency financial manager. Others simply came due while the manager was there. So kind of parsing out the part of the voters that said, you know, if a local district got in trouble on their own, the local population should be responsible. But there's also a side that says, but if when a state or a senior entity steps in, they bear some responsibility as well. So I look at both the proposal from the Detroit education community and the coalition that came out a few weeks ago, in addition to the governor's proposal, as kind of opening bids in that negotiation, that conversation about what is the state's responsibility moving forward.
So, Jeff, what is the general takeaway from this data, particularly if you're Governor Snyder and state lawmakers?
I think for Governor Snyder's perspective, these results are not surprising at all. It shows that the governor's perspective is correct, that there is a sense of obligation or duty on behalf of the state to the city of Detroit, and especially Detroit Public Schools. I think it also shows the work the governor and his staff have cut out for them in pitching and proposing different options to carry forward on that legacy. I think for the legislature as well, the what I'll call the measured skepticism that has been demonstrated so far is probably the right answer. Is the public's willing to entertain options and ideas? This isn't a firm no under no circumstances, but it's a what we heard, the answer is no, but we do feel a moral obligation. That tells me the answer from voters is keep talking. Show us some other options as well.
Meantime, we're releasing these results on Mackinac Island during the big policy conference this week. You've got some 1,600 lawmakers and business types and investors and stakeholders in the city. Jeff, what do you think you'll hear from them when you release this data?
I think these results match very well with the continual topics of education, specifically this year on talent, and again on race. All of those three topics, education, talent, and race, are mixed together when we talk about Detroit Public Schools and when we talk about the state's obligation. So as in years prior, I think we'll hear a lot of people asking questions about different perceptions or perspectives on Detroit. I also expect to hear a lot from some of the on-the-ground folks in Detroit, the nonprofits and the foundations, with what they're seeing in education in Detroit and kind of bringing the rest of us up to speed.
Jeff Williams, CEO of Public Sector Consultants, joining us once again in our Michigan's Pulse Polling Project, a collaboration between PSC and Michigan Radio. As always, Jeff Williams, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Over the past couple decades, our state's capital sure has seen quite a bit of change, and virtually no one has seen more of it than Chris Benson. Chris is getting ready to retire after serving nearly 20 years as a tour guide at the Capitol. During that time, he's seen the building restored, he's educated thousands of visitors on the Capitol's history, and even heard a ghost story or two. Chris Benson, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
So what does the job consist of?
Everything that goes on with tours, the tour scheduling, we probably do about 4,000 tours a year. We schedule basically all those. School groups, we do about 2,700 school groups. We also work with the rallies and events out front. Everyone sees us on TV, the rallies and the events that go on. And then a lot of people call, and they call our number for wanting to know about things, who to get in contact of. We're the first people you see when you come in the building. And so we get asked every question under the sun.
What's your favorite part of the tours?
The kids are so excited, especially, you know, they're out of school. That's the best part. But to see them see this building and people who've not been here before, the parents and chaperones, they have no clue when they come inside how beautiful that building is. And that's fun to show them.
When you think of the time you spent at the Capitol, there have been a lot of changes. What struck you as you've seen that evolve?
Oh, I was there when I first started working at the Capitol. It was not restored. You'd think of an old house, and that's just been let go.
And this needed love.
Yeah, it needed a lot of love. They were looking to build a new Capitol, actually, and there were skeptics to restore it. And then the price tag followed, and everyone freaked out.
And we should fix up what we have.
Exactly. They basically said, Cynthia, you're right, is maybe all we can afford to do is fix it up. And that was when a group came in, said we can not only fix it up, we can bring it back to its original splendor. They gave them the Senate chamber to do first. When they did that room on budget, it sold it. And that's the happy story.
Now that it's back to its glory, mm-hmm. What's your favorite part of the building?
The rotunda is the most fun for the kids, and so it makes it fun for the grown-ups, mm-hmm. too, because when the kids walk in on the glass floor, not only being on glass is cool, I mean, for starters, but to look up at the rotunda, it's 160 feet up to the dome from inside looking up, and then the kids lay down on the glass and look up, and it's pretty awesome. And then the Senate, because I love telling the Senate that when people see the building, that's the last stop. I tell them that story about this almost didn't happen.
Nice to see it back again.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Any fun secrets about the Capitol that you could share with us? Maybe some hidden passages or a ghost story?
Yeah, people always wonder. You know, yeah. People wonder, but I think it was kind of fun. I actually gave a tour to the Michigan Ghost Society. This is probably 15 years ago, and they wanted to see if there were ghosts in the building. And so I took them around, and they told me afterwards they could feel it. They could feel the vibes.
You talked about that 160-foot dome. Who painted that?
That's another classic story. It was built in the 1870s, but not painted till the 1880s. And they were looking for someone with the willpower, the guts, to paint the outside top of the dome, which actually the tippy top, the finial, sits 267 feet above the ground. Well, there weren't a lot of takers to paint the dome, which it painted buff white, I think, is the color. And one person, Chaddock is his name, was a Civil War veteran. He said he would do it, and he did, and he only had one arm. He painted, climbed up, block and tackle, everything, whatever they need to do all that stuff. He did it with one arm, and that's truly an amazing story. For people who haven't been to the Capitol, what a fantastic building. It really is. You got to just do a day trip. To visit that building. It's just something else.
Chris Benson, retiring after nearly two decades as a tour guide at the state capitol. Great to meet you. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Chris.
Thanks, Cynthia. It's been awesome.
Time now for Poetically Speaking, our ongoing series highlighting poetry in Michigan. Tarfia Faizula was born in Brooklyn, raised in Texas, but she now makes her home in Detroit. Her first book of poems is called Seam. It won the Crab Orchard Series in Poetry First Book Award. Her poems bring us the stories of the 200,000 to 400,000 Bangladeshi women who were raped during that country's 1971 Liberation War. It was a conflict that saw East Pakistan and India at war with West Pakistan, and that war led to the birth of the Bangladeshi Republic. Tarfia Faizula, welcome to the program. So good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you were born in the United States in 1980, and you were spared living through this war. But what about your family?
Both of my parents were in Bangladesh during the war. My father would have been a teenager, and my mother was a young girl during that time. And I didn't really hear very much about the war growing up until I happened upon this material about these women and then sort of realized that there was all of this history that was very much a part of my heritage and my family's heritage that I didn't end up realizing was there.
Like a light goes on. Tell us more about these women.
Well, these women were anywhere from, I don't know, the teens to their 30s, and they were raped by the Pakistani army during the war and also taken as sex slaves. And after the war was over, these women were lionized with the honorary term Birangana, which literally means war heroine. But as is often the case, I think it didn't really do what it was intended to do. It didn't take away the stigma from what they had experienced. And so they were often shunned by their social circles and their families. And
so given kind of a honorary title by the government, but in day-to-day life, there was a stigma.
Right. Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah. What struck you so much that it led you to produce these poems? And you made a trip, didn't you?
Yeah.
To talk with them.
Yeah. Well, I started writing the first of the interview poems in graduate school. I wanted to try to embody the voice of someone who had gone through that experience in wartime. But I eventually hit, I guess, a kind of ethical wall. I felt like I wasn't sure if I had the permission or the authority to speak for these women. And I realized that a lot of my research was just it was so superficial. It was little bits and pieces here and there. And I also really wanted to be in Bangladesh, to be in the landscape of that country writing these poems. So I applied for a Fulbright, and through the help of the Fulbright, I was able to go to Bangladesh and interview a number of these women and eventually wrote a book about the experience.
What did it do for you inside as you talked with these women and you heard their stories and then processed them into writing these poems? What did that do for your own identity?
Oh, gosh, so many things. I grew up in West Texas in Midland, in the Midland-Odessa area. And I was pretty confused, I think, the way a lot of young people, first generation, the product of first generation immigrants often are, I think, very confused about how to negotiate the culture that I was living in with the culture that was brought from Bangladesh via my parents and their social circles.
One foot in each world.
Right. And to complicate matters, my family is also Muslim, so there's a religious aspect there too that was confusing to navigate for a long time because I went to an Episcopalian private school. So, so I had this whole kind of range of experiences. And so I spent a lot of time, I've spent most of my life just trying to understand what it is to be a person in the world that has, you know, these attachments to various identities but isn't necessarily beholden to a single one of them. So, I ended up going to Bangladesh in part to try to understand that the Bangladeshi aspects of myself, I guess, and the Muslim aspects of myself. And also I think what it is to be a Bangladeshi woman, just period, which I think is a very difficult and complicated experience oftentimes. And I was also – I was raped myself in high school, so I felt a kinship with the women as well. Not a kinship exactly. I sort of felt like there was – even though the contexts are so very different.
Certainly.
And not really comparable.
But sexual violence.
But sexual violence. Yeah.
Well, if you would you share some of the poems with us now? And again, these are interviews. And tell us again that honorary name that these women have.
Birangana.
All right.
Yeah. Interview with a Birangana. What were you doing when they came for you? Gleaming water sweeps over mother's feet. Bayonets, teeth. My green and yellow Eid sari flaps damply between two palm trees. Grandfather calls to me, Mishti Maya, girl of sweetness. Ashi, I call back. I finish braiding my hair, tie it tight. I twine a red string around my thigh. That evening, a blade sliced through string, through skin, red on red on red. Kutta, the man in khaki says. It is only later I realize it is me he is calling dog, dog, dog. Interview with Ibrangana, 2. Where did the Pakistani military take you, and were there others there? Past the apothecary shop, shut down, burned flat, my heart seized, I told it to hush. They saw its shape and weight and wanted it too. Past the red mosque, where I first learned to touch my forehead low, to utter the wet words blown from my mouth again and again. Past the school draped with banners imploring, free our language, a rope steady around my throat as they pushed me toward the dark room, the silence clotted thick with a rotten smell, dense like pear blossoms, long strands of jute braided fast around our wrists. Yes, yes, there were others there.
That's poet Tarfia Faizullah reading from her award-winning first book of poetry, Seam. Her book brings us the stories of the 200,000 to 400,000 Bangladeshi women who were raped during that country's 1971 liberation war. That is so powerful and so moving. Did that process exorcise demons, if you will, from your own sexual assault when you were young?
I think the most powerful thing that happened is I stopped being afraid. There was something about the experience of, you know, not just hearing about these women's horror stories, but just seeing them in their lives, and you know, they laugh, you know, and as I think we all do in the end after we've been through something like that. And so I got great strength from you know, for example, seeing I was interviewing an entire family of sisters who this had all happened to. And of course, before I went to Bangladesh, it never occurred to me that it would happen to a whole family of sisters. And so seeing them take care of each other was really powerful. And I remember I was interviewing one sister and another one came up behind me and she started playing with my hair. And in Bangladesh, you don't see just curly hair kind of out and about. The upper class women tend to straighten it in salons and the working class tend to tie it back. So my hair, which is actually pretty Bangladeshi, was a signal of my foreignness somehow. And so a sister came up behind me and she started playing with my hair and she said, "You poor thing, you must have no one to comb your hair for you." And that experience was just, it just shook me to my core because I felt like I've been so afraid all along of being vulnerable and here these women are seeing me as something vulnerable. And I felt like rather than, you know, sort of like build the walls around me even higher, I felt like I was able to sort of just like stand straight again, which is really profound and beautiful.
Talk a little about your writing, Tarfia. What drew you to poetry in the first place and when?
I think my first experience of poetry was hearing the Quran growing up. My father has a really beautiful recitation voice and he's acted as an imam before. And, you know, like there, I learned that sound has meaning. You know, it's not just the definition of the words. It's also the sounds themselves have meaning. I think that's why we respond to song and melody the way we do. So that was my first early experience. And then, you know, and my mother also sort of like had me. She was really young when she had me. She was 18. And so what she had were nursery rhymes. And so she gave me nursery rhymes. And so I memorized these nursery rhymes at a really early age. And
The rhythm.
Yeah. And then the sort of the meaning of the words. There's a tape of me from a really young age, you know, sort of like vacillating between Bengali poetry and English poetry. And so I think those were just the earliest kind of like beginnings of it.
Can you describe the feelings you get when you're in the middle of writing a poem?
Oh, God, there's nothing like it. I think poetry has this quality of being able to sustain you in a feeling and sustain you in a moment. It can hold you there like a spell can. And so I feel when I'm writing, I feel sort of like held there. You know, I can't leave it. And I can't leave it until I've sort of like almost like a scientific experiment. I've exhausted the possibilities and reached a conclusion and found that there was an argument I was articulating that I didn't know all along. And so what it feels like to me is like learning. It feels like learning. And I think there's, when you're really learning, I don't think there's anything more exciting. I don't think there's any greater drug than the feeling of sort of your brain being hit by a voltage of knowledge, you know? So,
and emotion.
And emotion, absolutely. Yeah.
Definitely so, in these, a lot of emotion. Yeah. What do you see as the role of the poet?
I think the role of the poet is to not look away when you see something. Yeah, I think it's to look squarely at something and take the risk of trying to get that what you see across. You know, not just reportage, but interrogation. You know, mm-hmm. I think like I don't think it's an accident that classical oratory is so much like poetry. I mean, we trace our tradition back to music and to recitation both, and I think, you know, language. I heard poet Marie Howe say this recently. She said that language is action, and I think that's. I really agree with that. I feel like being able to look at something squarely on and being willing to try to encapsulate as much of it as possible in as pure a way as possible, and in as idiosyncratic a way as possible. You know, I think
your own unique voice.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering if you'd end by reading a poem from the end of your journey and at the end of your book, Seam.
Oh, sure.
And this one is?
This is Reading Willa Cather in Bangladesh. And it begins with a line from her novel, Song of the Lark. There were again things which seemed destined for her. I would give it up. This heaviness built of neither silence nor snow. I am there, but here, back in Virginia, walking through shadows of leaves imprinted damp on gray sidewalks. I would look toward their soil-etched wings and curl away from dim corners where shadows must be rubbed away from mirrors, where a TV might flicker with the figure of a woman dressed in green reading the news aloud from blue-inked pages. daily, it is possible to forget. I would give it up. The commotion of wrought iron windows looking out to fields of tea and rice, the failed light pouring through. I would turn from beggar hands pressed against glass, their hungry and open mouths. I would rather be here, pacing in a room papered with shadows of bare oak limbs, than there, sitting quietly in each dark room that holds its breath, waits for the hum of a generator to light its cement walls.
That is Hamtramck poet Tarfia Faizullah reading from her first book of poems. It's called Seam. It was a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for sharing your journey with us and your poems with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When a city's struggling, every single dollar is critical. So the idea that millions in federal dollars are being lost is appalling. But a new report from the Government Accountability Office shows that's exactly what's happened in Detroit and Flint, as well as Camden, New Jersey, and Stockton, California. Liz Farmer is a public finance writer for Governing Magazine. She dug into that report. Liz, what was this report looking at?
It was looking at how cities that struggle with their finances might be affected by how they manage the money that's given to them from the federal government. And this came about as we are seeing cities continue to struggle following the recession. Some are doing very well, but some are, especially in Michigan and California, are not. And we've seen bankruptcies, and it's just been really an unprecedented time. And so the federal government, of course, wants to know how that affects the money that they are spending that they get from them.
What kind of funds are we talking about? Money to do what, for instance?
Like housing projects, a lot of this stuff goes towards payroll-type things. You know, cities can establish a program, and then they'll use federal funds to pay for certain positions, the people who manage programs. But these are kind of all across the board. A lot of it is housing and urban development-type grants, so a lot of infrastructure, a lot of stuff that affects lower-income people in those kinds of programs.
So what they find, what exactly is going on in cities like Detroit and Flint where they're losing millions in federal funds?
The big problem seems to be that, you know, especially in Detroit and Flint, these two cities have saw some of the worst staffing losses during the recession. In 4 years, 2009 through 2013, Detroit lost a third of its city staff. Flint was even worse. It lost nearly half of its employees, and in a large part that's due to layoffs, but some of that's people who were just, you know, saw the writing on the wall and left. But if you can imagine, you know, any organization that loses that many employees in a short amount of time, yet they're charged with running a city every day, you're going to run into problems. And so this is true for the other cities in the report, too, but they lost that institutional knowledge. And with that, they lost the ability to really keep a handle on these grants.
So there's fewer people with kind of the skills and the knowledge to know what to do and how to manage those grants.
Exactly. They pointed out one example in Flint that because this one particular person left, of course, nobody's named in these reports, but this person had a deep knowledge of how to manage a particular HUD grant. And because of that, the money was possibly misspent. Flint couldn't go back and really determine whether it had spent money in, I guess, in accordance with how it was supposed to be spent with the grant. And so the result of that was that the city owed over $1 million back to HUD because it couldn't ensure that the money was going to the right places.
Oof. And then there was another problem in the sense of, you know, city has to do belt tightening and cut spending across the board. And then what happened?
Yeah, well, then what happens is they lose this expertise and they get dinged for it. The report cited a couple examples. Detroit has just had an appalling experience with these federal auditors. They go back in to see how the grant spending and money is going. And in a single year in 2011, in a single audit, Detroit had 90 compliance findings on one audit. The following year, there was 98. And so the city has just really had trouble with actually being able to comply. That results in several things. I mean, in some cases, the money doesn't even get spent at all because it's just sitting around and they don't have anyone to manage how to spend it.
And also, if the grants from the feds required a local spending match, those budget cuts meant they didn't have the money even to do it.
Exactly. Yeah, they can't put that aside.
This seems like a dog chasing its tail.
Yes. And what's interesting is, you know, obviously the cities know what's going on and this is not something that they're okay with. And so they've tried to establish solutions. And Detroit established an Office of Grant Management. Flint and also Stockton, California, too, established this pre-approval process where if you are an agency and you want to apply for a federal grant, you have to get final approval from the city finance manager before doing so. It's to ensure that you're going to do it correctly and all of that stuff. But what's interesting is, as we all know, there was a White House working group established to help Detroit. And for all the criticisms that this particular audit has for these cities not, you know, doing well with tracking how they're spending money, this working group didn't do very well with tracking its solutions either. And so other cities are knocking on the door going, hey, what kind of solutions did you guys figure out? And there aren't any answers. No one wrote anything down.
That made my eyes pop out when I read it in your piece, that the working group assembled to help Detroit didn't document its methods for others to use. I mean, hello.
Exactly.
Well, it's just the irony here is really it hurts when you think that the cities like Flint, like Detroit, most in need of extra funds, can't manage their grants because they're so resource strapped.
Yeah, they are. And it's just such a tough time. They are pulled in every which direction. Cities have to provide money to run the city every day. They have to pay for services. But these grants go for, you know, things that not only help that, but they might help, you know, something more long-term, like a bigger project or a beautification thing. You know, like these grants go to so many different things. And this is the city's only kind of lifeline to the federal government, yeah, other than community block development grants. I mean, this is important for them to be able to show that they can manage their money to the feds and that they are worthy of this money. And so if they can't prove that, they're not going to get the money.
Now, this federal report did offer some potential solutions. What were they? Besides the fact that it'd be nice to keep your records and keep methodology and document things.
Yeah, that's pretty important. I think that was probably, in my opinion, that's probably the most important solution.
Yeah.
And I would hope that they do that because there are, like I said, there are a lot of cities that want to use that as a kind of a blueprint for what to do. But another interesting point is that Detroit, in particular, has had a lot of success in partnering with nonprofits. And other cities are doing that, too, and that's sort of this new big thing, I think, that's emerged in the last few years. But the idea of a foundation going to the city and wanting to help with a particular area that the foundation is also interested in, that can reap a lot of benefits for both sides.
Interesting piece. But again, as I said, Liz, it felt like a dog chasing its tail. This whole cycle of they're so strapped they need the federal funds, but they're so strapped they can't manage the federal funds. It makes for some very challenging reading. Liz Farmer's piece in Governing Magazine, How Cities Lose Millions in Federal Funds. Thank you so much for talking with us, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
Gang members across the nation aren't just carrying guns these days. They're also armed with Twitter and Facebook. That's the focus of a study whose title really says it all, Internet Banging, New Trends in Social Media, Gang Violence, Masculinity, and Hip-Hop. It's co-authored by Desmond Patton. He's an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Social Work and the School of Information, and he's with us now. Desmond Patton, what was the focus of your study?
Sure. So the point of the study was to really deeply understand this new phenomenon where youth are engaging in a lot of different behaviors on social media. So just to give you some backstory, I'm a youth violence researcher, and I've been following youth in Chicago for quite some time in the neighborhoods, really trying to understand how they make sense of violence. And as I stayed connected with these youth, they spoke a lot about their social media connections and who they're talking to and how their social media interactions influence a lot of their behaviors.
For better or for worse.
Absolutely. And so I wanted to learn more about that. And so I wrote a conceptual paper with some of my colleagues from the University of Chicago to better understand and put some parameters around this phenomenon. And so what we did was we did some textual analysis of YouTube videos and Twitter communications, and also engage with the computer-mediated communications literature to better understand this phenomenon more deeply.
Meaning what?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And so essentially what we wanted to know is, what are the different ways in which youth are using social media? And to what extent is this a reappropriation of social media? Are they using it in ways in which social media was intended, or is this a different way in which youth are using social media?
What'd you find?
And we see that it's a little bit of both. And so, but in particular, some of the challenges around it is that youth, in particular, youth that are living in violent urban neighborhoods are expressing their lived experiences in those neighborhoods. And so everything that's happening, everything that they're engaging with in their neighborhood is coming across on social media. And so they're talking about violence. They're talking about poverty. They're talking about crime. They're talking about what they see and also what they engage in.
And, right? And when they're doing this, What are they talking about? Are they what are they sharing?
Yeah, and so they're talking about fights. They're talking about fights that they've been engaged in or fights that they're going to engage in. They're talking about people who have been killed or people that they may want to harm as well. They're talking about friends. They're talking about school. They're talking about being happy, about being sad. It's an array of things. But some of the challenges and the reason why I became very interested in it is because they are directly talking about taunts and making threats and things like that. And so I wanted to understand how and why that occurs.
So almost, you know, one thinks of you know, in West Side Story, the famous Jets and the Sharks number,
yes,
which was saying a lot about two gangs kind of squaring off.
Absolutely.
They're taking that today.
Absolutely.
And it's
yes,
on social media.
Absolutely. And the most notable interaction was between two rappers in Chicago. And this has been a reference point for gangs in Chicago for quite some time. So Chief Keef, who was a very well-known Chicago rapper, engaged in some Twitter beef or a battle with another rapper. And essentially the lesser-known rapper tweeted out his location and said, if you want to battle with me, meet me here. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, individuals did meet him there, and he was killed at the precise location in which he was
tweeting. This is the lesser rapper?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Which probably would not have happened if it had been so easy, had it not been so easy to tweet that out.
Absolutely. But again, this is the thing. Youth are bringing in how they negotiate and navigate community space. And so being tough is something that's very important when you're growing up in a Southside Chicago neighborhood. And you want to let people know that you're not afraid. And so you do the same things on Twitter.
Kids are doing that everywhere, aren't they, though? Aren't they carefully curating their public image on Twitter and on Instagram and Snapchat? I
Absolutely.
Mean, that's kind of a common theme with young people.
Very much so. Being popular and kind of creating your identity is very important on social media. It allows youth to kind of create or express multiple sides of themselves. And so you don't get to get the school self or the family self or their home self, but you get all of that and a self that they want to be as well.
But these kids you're looking at are in this tough urban environment, in this hip-hop environment, and danger and violence is a part of that.
Absolutely.
Is there any way for law enforcement to get in on this and to prevent, to shut down violence?
Yeah, so law enforcement have actually been involved in monitoring social media for quite some time. And so they're kind of up on this at this point. Mm-hmm. I think the problem has been we don't have the empirical research to back up some of the strategies in which they're using. And so I think that one of the things that I hope to do with my own work is to probably intercede and intervene in ways that help youth better learn how to communicate in ways that are promotive, and to be able to intercept some of these communications and redirect them to social service agencies and people that are in the communities that can help them before they get to law enforcement. Because a part of the challenge is a lot of the communication is hard to interpret. So if I were to bring some posts to you, it would feel like Greek. The use of emojis, numbers, letters that to the naked eye may not make a lot of sense. And so I question the extent to which the police have a full understanding and interpretation of these tweets and Facebook posts.
It's a language you've learned to speak through your research.
Absolutely.
If I'm going too far off into the weeds, rein me back in. But it makes me think of the stories that we've heard about ISIS and how skilled they are at spreading their jihadist message through social media and winning recruits.
Yes.
Is that comparable to what you're seeing these kids doing
in
the gangs?
It's interesting that you just bring this up. I just came back from the LA Gang Intervention Conference, and this particular incident came up. Absolutely. I think what we see is that social media is a way in which people have figured out this is a way to connect with young people. Young people spend their lives on social media, especially young people that are born digital, in which it's hard to distinguish between physical and virtual spaces. And so I think members of ISIS have figured out that this is a place in which they can recruit people because this is where they're located.
And we know they're doing it. So what do we take away from this? I mean, it's happening. Good luck trying to shut it down because someone else will pop up with another account.
Yeah.
What's the answer, Desmond?
Yeah, so I think it's complicated. But I think it's not necessarily the case that we should be shutting it down.
Okay.
But I think that youth are really trying to communicate something to adults that we are missing. I think that youth are telling us a lot about who they are, what they're involved in, what they're engaged in, what they're doing. And I think that adults are the ones that are kind of like, I don't know if this is right. Or they're the ones that are giving us pushback. But youth are really bringing us into their world.
Are they really?
They want
us involved? They want adults involved?
So I'm not sure to what extent they want adults involved.
Yeah, right.
but I would say that they are willing to communicate their lives. And issues around privacy become very complicated. I think that youth aren't necessarily intending to share as much, but because of this, you know, confusion and complexity around virtual and physical spaces, it happens. And so I think that what we need to think very critically about is, what are we dealing with here? And how can we use the information that we are privy to in this space to better support youth and help youth, as opposed to criminalizing youth and not using information to better support them?
And that actually leads to what I want to ask you.
Yeah.
What should we take away from your research? And also, what do you want to keep exploring?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think some of the takeaways are that youth, particularly youth who are growing up in very challenging communities, are expressing themselves in great ways. They're bringing us into their world. They're giving us very clear ideas of how they have to navigate violence and crime and poverty in their neighborhood context. And so I think that we need to think about that as a privilege and not necessarily as a point of criminalization, and that we could perhaps think very critically and deeply about how can we help youth? How can we intervene in the lives of youth based on what they're willing to share? So some of the work that I've been following a recently deceased gang member in Chicago that made headline news because she was a female gang member that was an assassin and had a very large Twitter following. And this young woman, although she was quite dangerous, and so I don't want to negate the fact that she did a lot of challenging things and harmed and hurt a lot of people. Mm-hmm. She was also expressing hurt and pain and would say things like, people don't know my pain. And when her best friends were killed, who were also in gang members, she emoted on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So it was really kind of bringing us into that space. And so I think that that's an interesting kind of space to be in. And what can we do with that? And I think that adults and police can think about ways to wrap around services using social media as a data point. And so some of my next steps is to better understand this phenomenon more deeply. And so I'm working with data scientists. I'm a qualitative social work researcher. I'm working with data scientists to fully understand this and to perhaps think about the development of interventions that can understand how youth are communicating, right? And so I'm working with folks in Chicago at the YMCA to interview youth about social media, about violence, and to have them also explain the communications in Twitter posts and in Facebook posts, and then use that information to work with data scientists that can then develop algorithms to detect what's happening. And then perhaps that information can be sent to social workers and health practitioners to better support youth.
Even church, if it's at whatever's in the neighborhood.
Absolutely.
Interesting research. Desmond Patton's study, Internet Banging, New Trends in Social Media, Gang Violence, Masculinity, and Hip-Hop, is published in the journal Computers in Human Behavior. Desmond is an assistant professor at the U of M School of Social Work and the School of Information. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and today's engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Sid Janwa, Joe Lindstra, Ava Ulbricht, Jake Offenhart, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.